It's now my honor to provide a brief introduction of Dr. D.J. Patil. His day started out early this morning with students, and he'll be spending some more time with students and faculty this afternoon. And we are truly grateful for his visit and for his willingness to spend so much time interacting with our academic community. Dr. Patil actually lived in Utah during his grade school years when his father was a member of the faculty at the University of Utah. Dr. Patil holds a BA in mathematics from the University of California at San Diego and a PhD in applied mathematics from the University of Maryland at College Park. He has the distinction of being appointed by President Obama as the first ever United States chief data scientist. In that role, he led a national effort to unleash the power of data to serve the American people by increasing the number and availability of databases. For example, Dr. Patil helped launch the White House's Police Data Initiative, as well as the White House's Data-Driven Justice Initiative, collecting data on police activities to enable investigation into patterns of injustice. He also worked on the Precision Medicine Initiative, aiming to build the largest database on genetic information to increase understanding of cancer treatments in rare diseases. Dr. Patil also has extensive experience in national security initiatives. He is an AAAS Science and Technology Policy Fellow for the Department of Defense, where he has directed new efforts to leverage social network analysis and the melding of computational and social sciences to anticipate emerging threats to the United States. He's also co-chaired a major review of U.S. efforts to prevent bioweapons proliferation in Central Asia. In recognition of his national security efforts, he was awarded the Department of Defense Medal for Distinguished Public Service. Just to give you a brief glimpse of a few more of Dr. Patil's myriad contributions, in the private sector, he has served as chief scientist, chief security officer, and head of analytics and data product teams at the LinkedIn Corporation. He's also held a number of roles at Skype, PayPal, and eBay. As a member of the faculty at the University of Maryland, his research is focused on nonlinear dynamics and chaos theory, and he helped to start a major research initiative on numerical weather prediction. He's also co-founded the Iraqi Virtual Science Library, which provides free, full-text access to thousands of scientific journals. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and so it's not surprising at all that in 2014 he was selected by the World Economic Forum as a young global leader. We're so pleased to have him speak to us today. Would you please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. D.J. Patil.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for bringing me back home. It's one of my greatest memories are here in Utah, and the community here in Utah was seminal in my upbringing and helping me in my early years formulate not only my thinking about the world, but also how to interact with the world. And then I'll talk a little bit about that. And, you know, the part I think that just here today and just would really start us off is to talk about, like, we live in such an incredible, remarkable time. I'm not talking about politics either. That's a different remarkable time. Maybe more for the Q&A, right? But just think about it for 10 years ago. 10 years ago, imagine what was in your pocket or your wallet. Your phone, it didn't take pictures. Videos was a foreign concept of why would your phone take a video? It used to carry a separate little thing of videos. You know, buying shoes on the internet was weird. Carrying stacks of maps when you got to a new place, that was normal behavior. You know, today, what do we have today? But not just what do we have today, what can we expect today? Our expectation is what when we get news, it is not only instant, up to date, but it is customized for us. Traffic, we want it completely in real time. We want that mapping to tell us how to not only get from point A to point B, but also all the alternative paths to get around any traffic between those two points. Need a car? Don't worry, car service. Lyft, Uber, pick your favorite one, get them all. Not only cars, but you can get now shipping. not just 2-day, but we're moving very quickly to 1-day shipping on demand. And then there's also the instrumentation of us as humans, fitness trackers, and all the things that can happen there, as well as into the area of clinical and what we're seeing happen in transforming hospitals about how patients have new data sources and are getting understanding of their bodies. And so we have truly seen a revolution of technology take place in our lifetime. And not just in this lifetime of a long arc of a single human time. In literally just a decade, we have seen this transformation that is complete. And so what's really behind that? What's behind all of that transformation? What I, of course, think of and when I think about that revolution and that foundation, it's data. It's data that is powering that and changing the whole paradigm. In particular, the aspects that we're seeing that are about to change into a complete new transformation and a radical new future is things like the Internet of Things, the instrumentation of devices from not only your washing machine to being able to talk to your microwave and have a debate about and judging you about the way you wash your clothes or heat up your food, but more about that the stoplights are fully wired to optimize for traffic flows. That when you get into an environment like a hospital or a big office building, it is automatically adjusting the temperatures for optimal climate control, but also energy efficiency. The ability to think in how do you wire all these systems together so that you can have truly autonomous vehicles, cars that self-drive, the ability to move transport with fully integrated systems. As those systems move, what's the next step is not only understanding ourselves at the fundamental level of what is our genome do, but what is our genomic profile, the way our genes actually manifest. How does that actually translate into science? How do we develop precision medicine, this idea of truly tailored medical treatments? And with that is this new evolution into the whole areas of not only data science, but machine learning and artificial intelligence. And so that really led to this establishment of this role of the chief data scientist. And by the way, it is a role that still is there. It's just not filled. But it is a role. And the administration currently has committed to actually filling it. And why have they committed to filling it? And why was this established? Because when you look across the paradigm, across the entire landscape of the United States, but also as the way the United States has used data historically, and one of those strongest historical lessons has been the census. Every 10 years, we redistribute our electoral process based on the distribution of our population. So how do we tie that in as we get to these new questions? And here's just a thought experiment. Right now, the census is done through a survey. It's a very sophisticated process. It takes years to figure out where we're actually going to have to sample people, make sure everyone is tallied, all of those things. But what happens when every part of our interaction with society is measured? If your device is your shirt, your pants, your skirt, your shoes, because it has some type of electronics in it, and it emits an electronic signal, that means that we can statistically calculate the census every day. We can calculate the census even faster. What does that mean for our society? Do we reallocate the House of Representatives every day? How do we think about the distribution of resources and those questions? Those questions all start to fall under the realm of the U.S. Chief Data Scientist. And so with that, with any role, you have to establish a mission statement. And so our mission statement that was established for this role by talking to many different people, not just in the Obama administration, but previous administrations, was this: to responsibly unleash the power of data to benefit all Americans. And there's two words in this mission statement that are very carefully chosen. And that is the word responsibly in all Americans. And the first word, responsibly, is there because just because we can with data doesn't mean we always should. How do we start asking the richer, deeper questions about what does that look like? The second question is all Americans. And we need to be very frank with ourselves about this, is that while we just talked about this revolution of data and technology that's happening, it is not happening for all Americans. It's happening for some Americans. And so the statement that I would assert that we should really be thinking about in our model is we think about any technology is out there, is that a technology should be considered neither radical nor revolutionary unless it benefits everyone. Everyone. What does that start to look like when we say the word everyone? And let's take just a quick gander at a problem, a very simple problem, and just like run through the numbers. So this year alone, let's talk about our criminal justice system. And one particular portion of our problem are jails. So just as a reminder, there's prisons and jails. Jails are typically happen at the county level, and if you're convicted of the crime, you may move on from the jail to a prison sentence. And there's multiple types of prisons. There's your state, but there's also your federal. So let's just talk about jail. If you get pulled over, if you go to jail, if there's some issue, whatever it is, you go to that local jail. Right now, this year, 11.4 million Americans will cycle through those 3,100 jails. And what I mean literally is cycle through those 3,100 jails. Because, on average, they will stay there 23 days. Yet, 95% of them will never go to prison. So who are these people? Who are these people that are cycling through these jails? They're the people with mental illnesses. They are people with drug addiction issues. There's also a number of bad actors that do need very serious other types of reform. So what's going on in here? What's going on in this? The biggest thing about that, which I would assert, is who pays for this problem? Because when this is going on and this cycling is happening, this is very expensive. In particular, if these are people that are going in to the system for opioid treatment or some other type of drug addiction or mental health illness, that is costing our local communities an extraordinary amount of money. That money is literally getting sucked away from paying another teacher, another police officer, putting a park in a town, or any other system. And so we have to figure out how to identify and deal with these problems. And so with that, let's take a look at one of these big facilities, Cook County Jail. It is one of our largest single-site jails. Our largest one overall is the LA County system, but this is a single-site one. It's 90 acres. It's almost 93 acres of jail. Cell phones don't work for miles around because no one wants to invest in the community around there. One-third of the inmates in this jail have mental health issues, and increasing. Where's the technology revolution for everyone that lives around this place? We have created, around this jail, which is just miles from downtown Chicago, an entire desert of a criminal justice system. Like, there, the children have no access to technology. You can't get one of these car services. You can't get the internet. Nothing exists for them. So where's the revolution for them? Let me give you an example of this. This is Pete and Kevin Early. Pete is actually a pretty famous author. His son is Kevin. Kevin has schizophrenia. And one night, Kevin had a psychotic episode. And he was having delusions. And so he broke into a neighbor's house and was naked and crawled up into the bathtub. Now, many of these type of incidents, when the police officer is called, end up very badly. They can end up badly for the officer. They can end up very badly for the person like Kevin. In this case, the officer was trained in something that's called crisis intervention and was able to recognize the signs of mental health illness and did not draw his service weapon, was able to de-escalate the situation and figure out how to get Kevin into this type of care. And what Pete points out is thanks to that system and that model, Kevin is effectively alive today because that system goes so badly wrong so many of the times today. And so what we asked ourselves is how do we take that and find a model that scales? And that's what we created as the White House Data-Driven Justice Initiative. And this idea is super simple. What it does is it says, look, we got a problem with our jails. We have a problem with mental health illness. We have to find a way to bridge this. So let's do something very elementary. These people who are cycling through the jails, let's figure out who they are. And let's share that information with the police department so that they know when they see someone like Kevin, they can intervene in the right way. Now, we're not talking any sophisticated machine learning or AI or any fancy buzz names. What we are literally looking at is a bunch of spreadsheets that say, hey, is Sally on your list? Because we see Sally all the time. Oh, yes, Sally's on our list. Do not take her to jail. Take her to the right treatment facility. Let's get her the help that she needs. Rocket science. Sharing of spreadsheets. How much could sharing a spreadsheet save? Well, Miami-Dade, Florida did this. They implemented this. Cost them $1.5 million to implement. How much did they save? $10 million in year one. The real measure is they emptied a full jail. They closed a full jail. A couple years later, they closed a second jail. Crime rates went down. Officer-involved assaults went way down. The whole system worked. So how do you scale it? Sharing spreadsheets. But you have to share them in a secure way that protects the privacy. So the data can only flow from the healthcare system into the criminal justice system. Here in Skid Row in Salt Lake City, I was with the sheriff, and what they've realized is that over 30 years of traditional models of just putting people in jail does not work. The costs are going up. The quality of outcomes is dropping. So they're doing new models too, where they have the jail, the intake facility, and right next to it, built into the same facility, is the mental health and drug treatment facility. So you get people right into the right care they need right away. That's the model we need to start to see shifted. Now, a similar model here, and this is one of my favorite pictures from the White House during our time. This is Grace Clark. Grace is about 13, 14 years old here. She's with the superintendent of police from New Orleans. And what I love about this picture of who's in control. How often do we see a young black woman, young girl here, in complete control of the situation? The reason she's in control is she is teaching the superintendent of police how to code his first line ever. And he's learning how to pull data about his system. And the beauty of this is when they pull the data, he says, that can't be right. And she says, well, it's your data. So they have a conversation. He says, I don't understand. We're supposed to be doing this and this. And he goes, exactly. So let's investigate it. Let's start looking at it. And this is what led us to this idea of sharing data between systems. So one of the things that we did at the White House after Ferguson is we took a whole bunch of these progressive police chiefs and others that are trying to figure out different ways. We took a bunch of civic activists as well as technologists. We put them in a room in the White House with presidential cupcakes, and we locked the door for 4 hours. Somehow White House cupcakes are like magic. And you know what they came back with? They came back with, they said, you know what? I have no idea how my police department's doing. I don't know how Salt Lake Police Department compares to Seattle, how it compares to Provo even, how it compares to Boston. So what if we opened up our data and shared it so kids like Grace Clark could look at it and find out what's right and what's wrong? And let's be super clear about something, and I want to explain it through an analogy here. When we often look at these problems, we point at this and we say, oh, it must be the bad officer. Let me tell you a quick story, though. We sent a team of data scientists from the University of Chicago into Charlotte-Mecklenburg County and to look at their data. And they did something which is called feature set selection, this idea of finding the features that predominantly describe a situation. And they were looking at officer-involved incidents, basically where excessive use of force. And so they went through the system and they looked for all these pieces of where bad things can happen. And there's a long list. And the list of features, the first list of things were obvious. You have a track record of accidents or complaints and so on and so on. And then in the middle of the features, there's two very curious things that show up. The first is that the officer has responded to domestic violence where a child is present. The other one is that the officer has responded to a suicide call or multiple suicide calls. So in this model, the data scientists are integrated with the officers, and so they've been traveling together, they've been doing the ride-alongs, they're figuring out how to use this data to improve. And they start looking at this, and they go, oh, wait a second, there's that first batch, which is due to some of the bad apples, and you can address those very easily. but what about what's happening with these others? And so what they realize is you go to a suicide, it's highly emotionally intense. It's physically messy. Domestic violence where a child is present. An incredibly tough situation. You finish that call, and what does dispatch tell you to do? Get back out there. Get back out on patrol. You pull some kid over, broken taillight, they're flippant with you. How can we expect a human who has just gone through that intense type of emotional system to then engage in this other type of situation? No one is human enough to context shift like that. Where is a failure happen? Why is it that we can build a system that is going to get you a package in a day, but we can't have a dispatch system that recognizes that you need some time off to decompress? Where is the system failing? And so what these data scientists are doing is building smart dispatch systems to take better care of the officers. And that is where we can start seeing these very new models of models of policing interaction happening. And that is really the theory behind what we call the White House Data Initiative, is using data to not only provide transparency, accountability, but also for people to share it to figure out how to improve systems. Systems that take care of the entire society that we're engaged with. We fundamentally have to find ways to make this technology work for us, not against us. And too often, we interact with a system where we just sit there and we are trying to click on it, or we know that this is so, so painful, that the technology is working against us. It's not there to help us. And we have to hold that technology to a higher bar. And let me give you a very specific example of that. This is Jennifer Bittner and her husband, Rod. That's her beautiful son. Jennifer has stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. For those that know anything about that, that is terminal. She's doing okay. But she wrote into us when we were working on this idea of what does the next generation of treatment need to look like. And she pointed out that if you look at the curves of how long someone survives for someone with cancer like her, she's not going to be around long enough to watch her son ride a bike. And she said, hey, you guys are so smart. You keep talking about accelerating the course of technology, accelerating the course of science. How are you going to help allow and empower me to see my child grow up? She had a point. She had a real point. So what's holding back a solution for saving Jennifer? Getting a cure for all our loved ones with cancer. What turns out, what's his most painful is it's just a database. There's data out there. The problem is it's fractured across thousands and thousands of databases, and there's no way to bring this data together. So what would happen and what would it look like if we took all the data sets that humanity has and brought it together in a safe, secure, private, privacy-controlled way to allow us to look at solutions for these diseases? What might we come up with? Because the answer already exists in the database. We just haven't figured out how to look for it. What does that start to look like? And so that's why we launched these things like Precision Medicine Initiative and Cancer Moonshot, because what we're realizing is all too likely the cure is already out there. We just haven't figured out how to ask the right question of the data and bring it together. And that's all too powerful. That's an option for us as a nation, and we have to figure out how to take a better advantage of it. And so those things are taking off and going at an incredible rate. And that foundation of part of that is this idea of how data science starts to empower these things. And so those are elements, what I've talked about is a little bit of our own data, but I want to show you a few other cases how data is transforming the world. And let me start with the story of Matt Might. This is Matt, his son Bertrand. We're at the White House bowling alley celebrating Matt's birthday. Matt here was a former resident of Utah before we convinced him to move out to the White House to help us on precision medicine. And here's the thing. Here's the story of Matt, of Bertrand. Bertrand was, when he was born, there was something that just wasn't quite right. His parents noticed it and weren't sure exactly what to do. And one of the signatures of it was, it wasn't acquiring language, wasn't engaging in the same way. But one of the surefire signs of that was that when Bertrand cried, there was no tears. It did not produce tears. And so Matt went to every specialist that he could, great quality healthcare here in Utah, went to the experts, and they all told him the same thing. Your son is one of N, which basically means your son has a genetic disease where he's the only human like that in the world. We have no others like him. So what is that genetic disease? Well, this is early on. People weren't able to pin it down. They just said one of N. So Matt, though, is a computer scientist, and he said, I don't believe that. So he decided to game the system. And the way he gamed the system is he wrote a blog post that was titled, Searching for My Son's Killer. And he put all the characteristics in there of what he was trying to find. And he optimized this blog post so that any other parent who might have similar symptoms in their child would come across his blog post. And then, sure enough, multiple parents started to show up with their kids having the same symptoms. So Duke University did a very high-res sequencing of Bertrand's genome. They found out that there's a defect on what's called N-glycol-1. And they figured out, hey, wait a second, we can might be able to do something about it. So then what Matt did is Matt decided to look at this and looked at the data of all the drugs that are out there and realized that there's what's called off-label use. Basically, that you might be able to take these drugs and test them on himself and then eventually on Bertrand, becoming his own FDA, if you will, to figure out if there's a solution to cure Bertrand. And Matt actually has a video of this moment, the first time he tries one of these drugs and gives it to Bertrand, and as a result, Bertrand actually produces tears. This is the stuff like we talk about in movies. This is happening all around the world. This is what happens when you have a scientist like Matt empowered to do this. But it's not just him. This is Sonia and Eric. Sonia's mom died of a horrific genetic disease. It's just far too young. It's one that just destroys your brain, wastes away. It's very, very painful. So Sonia had to go through this very difficult decision to get genetically tested. And what would she find if she was genetically tested? They were newlyweds. What do you do in that situation? So they decided to do the test, and it turns out Sonia has better than a 50% chance of actually coming down with this genetic disease. They're a lawyer and a city planner. So what do you do? What do you do in that situation? Well, you quit and become data scientists. So one of them became the wet lab. The other became the computational specialist. They gave up their jobs, they went and got their PhDs, they got postdocs at the Broad Institute, and they're literally in a race to find a cure for Sonia. They just had their first child about 4 months ago. When we empower people with data, we find that they do amazing things. These are presidential innovation fellows that come in from all walks of life to come and serve in the government, to figure out how to open up data. Open up data from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that is the type of data that different journalists can use to figure out that there is an opioid epidemic. The type of data that when opened up recognizes that more than 100 Americans are going to die on our highways and roads today, and we don't know why. Some of it is distracted driving. Some of it is faster driving. Some of it is bike incidents. Some of it is better fuel efficiency, so people are driving longer distances and faster. We can't exactly figure it out, but by opening up that data and flipping around the model, we know that Americans and the ingenuity of the American public can find different answers, just like Sonia did, just like Eric is doing, just like Matt Malliot is doing. But there's others. This is Antwi. Antwi is in Chicago, and he's using local data to figure out how to make his community better. Just at that very, very community level type data. Figure out how to improve just basic services. This is Sujana. Sujana came to us at the White House Science Fair. amazing young woman in Kentucky, University of Kentucky, thinks she's so good they've given her a whole lab because she might be the first person to figure out how to develop the artificial kidney, a problem that causes way too much life, loss of life in our nation, but also costs $30 billion a year. And so she's doing this, and she was doing this work while in high school. We have people like the team in Charlotte who are trying to figure out how do you actually build great interfaces so that when somebody moves to Charlotte for the first time, they can figure out how to get great services. Who are these people that move in? We often have that mental model, the people that move in must be immigrants. No, it's veterans just moving out of the armed forces, entering a new community. It's domestic violence victims who are trying to get a fresh start in a new community. How did they figure that out? They looked at the data. They're finding these incredible new models. There's other places too, and we have to remember that in our communities, not all of our communities are counted. There are a million black men who did not appear in the last census because they are in our criminal justice system. This is one around the LGBT groups. They have not figured out how they want to be counted. And so we brought a team of them together to figure out how would they actually want to be represented and what does that system need to look like. But there's more. We look at our youth. This is Tilly. Tilly, this is an amazing young girl. And if you look at what her hand that's on the red notebook, that's a robotic hand. We are now able to create these devices that allow her not to just have a regular human experience with an arm, but that arm that she has is a robotic superpower. These robotic arms have the strength that is phenomenal and dexterity that rivals human touch. How do we empower that? How do we empower kids to do that? How do we design a technology that is for everyone? It's for Tilly as well. This is Rebecca and Kimberly. They are guaranteed to give you a complex because when they were 6 and 8, they figured out how to launch a toy cat into space. I don't know what you were doing at 6 and 8, but I was definitely not thinking about how to launch something into space. And they are, this is the future. Kids empowered. And how did they figure this out? How did they get this idea? You talk to them, you're like, okay, you're 6 and 8. How did you get the idea to launch something in space? YouTube. It's like, of course. They said, I saw somebody else trying it, so we thought we'd try it. So why not? And they were like, well, then we got this little video camera and we stuck it on there and we're like, well, something should be in front of the camera. Let's put a toy cat and see what that seemed fun. That's where innovation starts. This is Steve. Steve is here. Steve has barely one use of his hand. Steve, he goes by the, on Twitter as, I think it was one-armed bandit hacker. He is figuring out how to, he codes like a maniac. And what's he coding? He and his team in Chicago have figured out that they are going to map where any place where a sidewalk has too much of a crack or that the curb does not go down nice as a nice ramp to figure out things. That's the power of this type of data. And it goes on. Teams in South Bend, Indiana that are figuring out how to empower the city through the use of technology APIs. One of the things that we've been fortunate, we have had back-to-back Olympiads where the U.S. has won the gold medal. And part of that, of how they actually interact, these kids are from all around the country. We are working to make sure that the next team actually has more women and girls on it. But the part of what actually is there that they do is they communicate through all these distributed systems like Google Talk and Skype and all these other things. And they're able to share and do really interesting problems and have fun with math. But the other side also there is working on suicide problems. This is a hackathon that we had that Sean Taylor, who is trying to figure out how do we use Facebook targeting and ad systems to understand when someone is in crisis and intervention. We've also need to talk about our military and the support they need. One of the things that we put in place, especially around the questions right now of our systems being under attack is this idea of we invited people to hack the Pentagon, is what we called it. So we invited a whole bunch of white hat hackers. These are good hackers who have been vetted. And we invited them to the Pentagon and said, bring it on. You know how long bring it on took to find our first flaw? 13 minutes. Now, the kid there, and he's literally a kid at this picture, David is 18 in this, while studying for the AP computer science exam, he found 6 vulnerabilities in the Pentagon, submitted them, and this is him getting a recognition from Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. I don't let people say, oh, you invited people to hack the Pentagon. How could you do that? The bad guys are going to know this. We're like, the bad guys already knew about this. We should probably know about it too. How do we flip these models on its head? And part of this is also these new distributed systems. There's a system that we created called Crisis Text Line, all volunteer network where people text in instead of calling in suicide hotlines. Because what we found is people don't want to call anymore. They like to text. Here's the amazing thing when you do that. You can use natural language processing, AI technologies to look at the words they use. And if somebody is using the word Tylenol, aspirin, Advil, they are 4 to 16 times more likely to be in the act of committing suicide. And we can start intervening by trying to get an ambulance out to them right then, because we see the way the patterns that they're using. How do we use that technology for good? And it's not always great. One of the things that does happen sometimes, and this is one of the tragedies, is we had one of the people on our team killed, Jake Brewer, and this is his daughter. And what Jake pointed out is that we really need to start asking ourselves that harder set of questions. And one of the things he pushed at the White House was this idea to take a pledge, an oath. What would a pledge or an oath to do the right thing around technology really look like? And that pledge, this is the pledge that he was pushing for. I think there's a couple parts that are really critical, is what does it mean to pledge to be an active American? What does it mean to be a pledge to serve, to push our country to be right? What does it mean when it's wrong to stand up? What does it mean to stand up for each other, for groups that don't have a voice, that don't have recourse? What does it mean to really pledge to be like a citizen, especially in this age of technology? Those are fundamental questions that all of you are empowered to take on, because the engine that we've talked about is really driven by the next generation tackling these problems. Because let's be honest, not only was our democratic processes hacked and attacked by other governments, but we have a fundamental problem of what is the engagement of our technology, whether it's a news feed, or the way you see ads, or the way we get our news. What does it look like when systems put in bias? Those questions we have to answer now. And so the 3 core principles I want you to take away today is that people are always greater than data. People are greater than data. When we talk about those data points, they have names. The edge cases we often refer to as maybe that's not a group we should consider. Those edge cases have names. Juan, Sally, Jesse, Marcos, they all have names, and we have to do a better job fighting on their behalf. Data is a force multiplier. How do we get into more hands so that we have the Sonias, the Erics, the Matt Mites, the kids that are Kimberly's and Rebecca's who are trying to launch things in space, the Sujanas, the Jose's? How do we empower them to do more, to find solutions? And then finally, that time to engage is now. We have to engage now, because these technologies are not only being implemented in our systems, but around the world in different radical ways. And we have to address that right now. So how do we make it happen? And what I want to do is I want to share with you the note card I kept in with me at the White House. This is a note card that I wrote early on to just keep a framing around problems. And it starts with this. Dream in years, plan in months, evaluate in weeks, but always ship daily. Shipping is a term we use in technology to deliver a solution, build something. Shipping could be writing. It could be talking with somebody. Find some way to be proactive every day, but dream in those years, plan in those months, evaluate in weeks, but do something today. Second, prototype for 1x, but build for 10x and engineer for 100x. Start small, figure out how to make it a little bit bigger and scale it. Take ideas that others might have, combine them, make it a we problem, not an I thing. Make it a more. And finally, always ask what's required to cut the timeline in half and what's required to double the impact. Push ourselves to go cut our time to finding a cure for cancer in half. Double the impact of finding a way to make sure every child has the opportunity to have something not only to eat, but have quality education. How can we double our impact? When we ask these questions, we see radical transformation in the ideas that take place, whether it's in something criminal justice or something about healthcare. All of it is open, wide open turf for all of you to take action and find new solutions. And finally, let me just return to this component, this point I want to emphasize. I just showed you and talked a whole bunch about data science, but the thing I want you to recognize is I haven't shown you a single equation. I haven't shown you a single graph. There's no math. The only thing I've done is told you the stories of those that are impacted by data or those that are doing amazing things with data. And the fundamental point at the end of the day is that no matter how much technology and data we use, it's about people first. People first. It's about our population. It's about our citizen. It's about us as a country coming together, using all these things, but always at the end of the day, people first at the end of all of this. Thank you.